I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Past Imperfect. I'm Alice Thompson.
And I'm Rachel Sylvester. And we're talking to remarkable people who've overcome adversity or trauma in their childhood years to achieve extraordinary things.
Our guest today is an inventor, engineer, entrepreneur and farmer who is still best known for his bagless vacuum cleaner.
Sir James Dyson is Britain's richest man with a wealth of more than £16 billion, a university, an art collection and an extraordinary country estate.
He's also the largest landowner in England, farming more than 35,000 acres of peas and potatoes, although he calls himself a farmer from North Norfolk, as well as having a global business making his hand dryers and hair dryers.
Yet for most of his life, he was counting the pennies. His father died when he was nine. He found academic work a challenge, and he's suffered multiple setbacks as he struggled to sell his inventions.
The secret of success, he insists, is to embrace failure and learn from it. He built and tested more than 5,000 prototypes of his vacuum cleaner before finding the one that worked.
He still pushes himself in his 70s, admitting, "It is scary. I'm scared all the time. Fear, though, can be a good thing as it pumps the adrenaline and motivates."
James Dyson, thank you very much for joining us on Past Imperfect. We're fascinated on this show by the power of flaws and imperfections in life. Why do you think failure is just so important in business?
Well, I think it's important everywhere because you learn from failures. You know, why did that fail? How can I make it work? And that's in solving that problem, you're achieving something, you're making progress. Whereas success, you sort of sit back and enjoy the success without questioning, how could I have made it better? So I think failure is really important to embrace it, not worry about it, but actually come to rather enjoy it, however big the setback is. But if we have too much fear of it, it stymies us, it paralyzes us.
When we want to take you back to your childhood, because although you've been incredibly successful in your life since, and your childhood seems pretty idyllic, you were born just after the war in austerity Britain, and you grew up in Norfolk, surrounded by vast beaches, infinite horizons, and English countryside. Can you describe it? What was it like? What were your earliest memories?
Well, as you say, we lived in North Norfolk, and people didn't go to North Norfolk in those days. It was a very cut-off part of the country, although it was still trains went to it. But you know, people didn't travel then. People stayed in the same hometown. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful place. It's got the most extraordinary coastline. You've got Sheringham and Cromer and West Runton, which are traditional seasides with sand and sea and deck chairs and things. And then you get into the really interesting bit beyond Weybourne, to Blakeney Point and Abraham's Bosom, they call it, and the much talked about beautiful, beautiful Holcombe Beach and Skult Head and so on, all the way to Hunstanton. It's the most beautiful, beautiful coastline. I mean, the only problem with it is the sea's very cold. And also, there's nothing between you and the North Pole in one direction and Siberia in the other. But and it's very flat, although it's not actually quite so flat in North Norfolk. As you say, you bought in local shops. There were no supermarkets. There was no television. The first television I ever saw was the coronation in 1953 at a friend's television, a richer friend's television. We didn't have a television. And so you did things. I mean, we built tunnels, we climbed trees, we sailed boats. It's a typical Arthur Ransom idyllic upbringing with no money, but freedom, the most beautiful countryside, no health and safety. And I was really fortunate to be brought up almost inside Gresham School, which has huge grounds and beautiful facilities. So in the holidays, we could swim in the swimming pool, play in the tennis courts, play in the squash courts. And when the swimming pool froze open in the winter, we went and played ice hockey on it. So, I mean, but not with the proper gear, but with ordinary hockey sticks and tennis balls. But, there were a little group of us. I mean, the children of teachers, post-war children of teachers whose parents had come back from the Army or Navy or the Air Force during the war. So it was a very unreal time in a way, but idyllic. And money wasn't important at all, because we had this beautiful landscape and the most glorious of times with our friends using the facilities. So I was really, really lucky.
And you had a very academic older brother and older sister. Were you always the rebellious third child, do you think? Do you feel you had to keep up or had to be different?
Yes, I think I was a typical third child. Yes, my brother was brilliant. I mean, you could sing him a song and he'd sing it back to the correct tune and with the correct words. I mean, what can you do if you've got a brother like that? And he went on to... I don't think he worked that hard, but he went on to get an open classics scholarship at Cambridge. It was a hard act to follow. So I did things my way. I did things I enjoyed doing, which is sort of everything else but work at school.
You even learned the bassoon, didn't you?
I was nine, and the headmaster announced at prayers that they needed people to play the oboe, the violin, and the bassoon. And I put my hand up because I had no idea what it was. So I thought I'd have a go at it. So I think I like that sort of challenge.
And your father, Alex, sounded like an extraordinary figure in a way, because he served in Burma in sort of sniper-infested jungles and then came back to teach at Gresham's, and he ran the cadet force, and he was coaching hockey and rugby and playing recorder. Sounded like an extraordinary polymath. He was incredibly charismatic, but also quite eccentric, probably. Did that enthusiasm impart itself in you?
I think it must have. I think those things do rub off on people. He did everything. I mean, he played the recorder in a recording group. He produced the school plays. He did a Shakespeare play every year in the open. We had a lovely big open theatre. And I've still got his miniature volumes of Shakespeare, which are hardly bigger than a matchbox, with his notes in it written in pencil. So he produced plays. He played hockey, played rugger. Coached hockey and rugger. He was head of the school CCF, the Combined Cadet Force. He sailed. He sailed with the school sailing club. At home, he made lead soldiers. Very keen amateur photographer, so we printed our own pictures in the darkroom, which was really interesting as a child, watching the image appear on the paper in the developing tank. And we had a vegetable garden, and we kept ducks and chickens and things. He was just incredibly busy all the time. Mm. He never stood still. Mm. I've got a photo of him sitting reading in the evening, but I don't really remember him ever doing that. He was always doing things.
And your mother was 5'11", which probably explains why you're so tall, but she taught you to sew and to do crafts, didn't she? And I mean, she also sounds like she was a very good painter as well.
Yes, and my father, yes. She was a good painter. She left school at 17. She was at the Perth School in Cambridge. She left at 17, so didn't go to university, but instead pushed around those aircraft positions at RAF Tangmere in Sussex, with Winston Churchill looking off from the balcony. She did that and then married my father and had children through the war. And then after my father died, she went to teacher training college and ultimately Cambridge to read English at the age of 50. And then she died 5 years later of cancer. But so she and I were students at the same time, which was rather fun.
Did you do anything together at all? I mean, did you go off to the cinema or Freshers Week? They probably didn't have Freshers Week then.
We went on holidays, to camping holidays to Scotland, where it rained and blew and rained and blew. And finally the tent blew away. We were playing Racing Demon and eating porridge because it was pouring with rain outside. And it was before the days of built-in ground sheets. And the whole thing blew away, so all our playing cards went over the field. So we gave up Scotland and went across to France in our Maurice Minor and travelled across France, which was lovely. And she dragged me round all the churches and cathedrals and things, which I didn't really want to do, but I'm really glad she did it.
And then when you were 8, you were driving back from a family holiday in Cornwall and you stopped for a picnic. Can you just describe what happened?
Yes, it was our last family holiday. We stayed in a friend's cottage at Polzeath. And we stopped on Dartmoor because we had a big old Standard 12 with a... No, it didn't have a caravan, but it was a big old Standard 12. And we stopped for a picnic. And I was walking through the bracken, exploring Dartmoor, and I came around the corner and saw my father being violently sick, and it was a particularly nasty colour sick. And he said, "Don't tell Mummy."
Right.
Yeah, so we wandered back, and I kept silent.
And did you immediately realise it was something quite serious?
Do you know, I don't think I did, really. Mm. I knew he was ill, and he was having severe radiation. I mean, he had huge red circles on his chest and on his back because he had lung and throat cancer. And I remember being appalled at that and saying, "What is that?" You know, and he explained it. But, I mean, people didn't talk about cancer in those days. You didn't understand that cancer was a killer because people just didn't talk about it.
Mm.
And anyway, as an 8-year-old, I wouldn't really have been aware of it.
When was the last time you saw him? Because he kept going up and down to London to have treatment. Did you realise ever that you were saying goodbye to him?
No, not at all. No, he, I mean, he went to London for long spells for treatment and then came back. And then the last time I saw him, he was carrying his little suitcase, leather suitcase. He said goodbye to us and walked to the station, which is a 20-minute walk. And that was the last time I ever saw him.
Can you still visualise that? Yes.
No, yeah.
Hmm.
Very much so.
Was he incredibly stoic?
Well, in retrospect, I mean, I was saying goodbye to Dad. He was off to hospital, but I didn't know he was going to die. But it's his courage and...
Do you think he knew he was going for the last time?
He must have known there was a big chance of that. I think the doctors must have been fairly honest with him.
And can you remember how you found out that he died and what you felt
that moment? Yes, he actually wrote us letters. So I think he knew he was dying. And now I was sitting with my mother and my brother having, strange enough, asparagus soup. I remember the soup. Mm. And there was a phone call, and then my mother came in and gave us the news.
Mm. And what did he say in his letter to you?
Oh, I think it was a how to live your life sort of letter.
Have you still got it?
Yes, I have.
Mm. Do you read it sometimes?
No, I can't find it at the moment. I know I've got it, but I can't find it.
He'd be absolutely sort of amazed by what you've done, though, wouldn't he? Because he can't have imagined in the letter that he was ever going to put, you know, become an inventor, you know, a farmer, polymath.
Yes, I think he'd have been, I think he'd have been disappointed in me at school, but then pleased with what I've done since. Rather like my mother. My mother died long before I started the vacuum cleaner company, but I'd been making wheelbarrows, ball bearers, and being an inventor and a designer. And she was really interested and loved that. I think she was really pleased I did something different and sort of surprised. In a nice way.
Mm-hmm. And what did the head teacher or the teachers say to you? Were they very supportive, or were you pretty much on your own, stiff upper lip?
Oh, on my own, stiff upper lip, treated like all the other boys.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. That was absolutely the right thing to do.
Do you think so? But,
yes.
Do you still do it, then? Do you think it's better to bottle it up? Or?
No, I don't think that. But I don't think a child should be treated any differently because they've had a disaster like that.
Right.
I mean, in front of other children, but maybe
you don't want to be different.
Privately, show sympathy and empathy.
But how often did you see your mother then? Did you just go back in holidays or?
Well, yes, that's the thing. We were allowed out for part of Sunday 3 times a year, so I saw her then. But otherwise, I wasn't allowed to go home. And it's odd because it was almost part of the school, the house, so I had to walk past it but not go in it. Couldn't nip in and get a biscuit or something like that, and I had to walk past it. And
but that must have been incredibly hard for her as well, because she must have missed you and your brother as well as your father.
Yes, but she used to come and watch games, some school matches and some school events. So I saw her then and briefly afterwards. But, you know, I was like any other boarder.
Yeah.
I didn't feel different because of that.
Yeah.
It was just slightly odd, but that it was all so close. And maybe that was a help, actually.
Mm. And do you think you can assess now what sort of impact it had on you losing your father that young? Because so many people that Rachel and I have interviewed have lost a parent very young, and it does seem to provide this sort of really almost like spur to success sometimes, that you want to do something, you want to feel that you're continuing their life in some way or proving yourself.
Yes, probably all of those. But I think that you suddenly realise how alone you are. You've lost one of my guides. And I had no father to give an example or to be able to do sort of fatherly things with. But I think this feeling of being on your own is what I felt the most. And I mean, part of that's rather nice, actually. but I think you inevitably, therefore, make lots of mistakes and learn from them. And I certainly, the decision to be a little bit of a rebel at school and not do everything other than work hard academically. I mean, I did work academically, but I didn't swat and revise and do all those sort of things. Although I also did A-level English as well as Latin, Greek and ancient history and art. And I loved English. I mean, I failed it, but I loved it because, you know, I didn't revise. I'd much rather go and act in a play or play rugger or go running or something than do revision, play the bassoon, than do revision. But the important thing for me was having done it, actually, not the exam result.
So do you think that aloneness, or does it give you a kind of self-reliance that's useful in business? Or is it that you're willing to take risks, you've got nothing to lose? Are there qualities that come from having suffered pain at an early age, do you think that...
Certainly I had nothing to lose, and so I'm not frightened of taking risks. I've got a lot to lose now, but I do still take risks, because actually I like living on the edge. That's probably part of that upbringing, that there was never any money, and I had no one to turn to. Even when I was a student, I had no one to turn to, because my mother was also a student with no money. So I think the self-reliance is there. Willingness to take risks, quite enjoying living on the edge with a massive overdraft. I call that putting money to good use, but the bank managers might have another view on that. But I enjoy that. And maybe that's because, you know, I lost my father and then I lost my mother. But particularly losing my father, there was no one to turn to. I was completely on my own. And perhaps being sent off to boarding school at that point accentuated that. Mm. You know, I really was on my own. There were all these other boys there who had parents, often rich parents. All I had was a very poor mother.
Mm.
No one giving me advice.
And you became a long-distance runner, which is even more lonely in a way, isn't it? But particularly on that sort of very flat land. I have this sort of vision of you. You know, running along in sort of mud flats,
yes,
in the pouring rain.
Tony Richardson's The Loneliness and Long Distance Runner with Tom Courtney, that came out at about that time. Mm. Yeah, and I loved running. I mean, I discovered I was good at it at school. So suddenly I was at the front and then thought, oh, I can win this. And then I loved the training. I don't love it now. I do. I still run, but it's painful now. But in those days it was... One had boundless energy, and I used to run everywhere, actually, as a child. I never walked. I couldn't see the point of walking. I ran everywhere.
Impatient.
And so running came very naturally to me, and running in North Norfolk is actually lovely. I'm running in lots of places, it's lovely, but North Norfolk, running across the heathland and out to Blakeney Point and back, just really running through farmland. Which there is mostly crops rather than cows that might chase you. It was freedom. It was getting out of boarding school on my own, doing something entirely on my own, and relying on myself. I mean, in a running race, you're on your own. It's not a team event. which is not to say I didn't enjoy team sports, I enjoyed those as well, but this was something I could do on my own and prove myself on my own.
Your headmaster wrote a brilliant end, didn't he, that was, I cannot believe that he's not really quite intelligent, in your report when you left, which actually is a double negative, but rather apposite, probably.
It was a great, he was great at those sort of comments. And he's, thank God he was partly right. No, I got on very well with him. He was, if you were ill, you had to get headmaster's signature so you could show this chit to people in every class, the master in every class you went to, that you had been ill, you hadn't been skiving off.
Mm-mm.
And I'd had diarrhea. And he said, I'm not going to sign it until you spell it correctly. I still can't spell it correctly. I actually discovered there's about three different ways of spelling it.
And do you think your creativity and originality comes from having a brain that works in a different way at all? Or do you have a sort of different spatial awareness? Or is it all about personality?
Oh, I think, I can draw.
Yeah,
And I went to art school for a year to do drawing and painting and really learned to draw properly. And yes, I know my brain does work in a different way. It doesn't follow the straight train track that other people's brains follow. And yeah, the spatial awareness. I mean, I can go somewhere. There's that wonderful dyslexic child that drew the whole of King's Cross Station. Do you remember? And Hugh Casson used to champion him. I'm nothing like that, but I can go somewhere and draw the building afterwards, or draw a complete 3D plan of something, having been somewhere.
Amazing.
So I've got that 3D spatial awareness, as you call it.
Mm. Do you think not doing an academic subject at university, do you think that in a way actually made you want to prove yourself more, that you wanted to show that you could be just as successful going to art school or doing something really creative rather than doing classics, which would have been the obvious other one to do with your dad?
I know what you're saying, but no, I didn't feel like that. When I got to the college, I worked incredibly hard and realised that I'd come home. You know, this is what I wanted to do. And so worked very hard. I wasn't trying to prove that I could be as successful as a very clever exhibitionist at Cambridge, exhibitioner at Cambridge. I didn't feel the need to compete with academics at all. Although subsequently, I suppose the brilliant first at Oxford, the brilliant first at Cambridge, those sort of people, the people who run the country and the people who are very successful and very successful in business as well. There was a certain... and I've always felt it, that because I'm a designer and engineer, I can't be good at business. I can't run a company. And I think that's absolute nonsense. I mean, there's really no such thing as a businessman. I mean, what is a businessman? So when I went to raise money to start the vacuum cleaner company, quite a few of the, they were called venture capitalists in those days, they're private equity now, said, well, you're not a businessman. I mean, you might have a good vacuum cleaner, but if you get someone from industry to run it, then we might consider backing it. So it's my point is that being a designer or an engineer doesn't stop you running a business.
No. But in a way, do you quite like that, being an outsider, not
yes,
being the conventional businessman?
Yes, I do. I slightly wallow in that. I quite enjoy that, yes. I slightly enjoy... I'm slightly suspicious of experts. And Jeremy Fry, my only boss, taught me to be suspicious of experts.
But you are an expert in a way. I mean, you are definitely with a vacuumless...
Yeah, but the moment you think you're an expert, you're in trouble.
Okay.
Why? Because you become smug.
You're living off your past.
Right.
And it gets in the way. Okay. It inhibits you.
But you must know more
you.
About hairdryers than 0.01% of this population.
Okay, well, I love hairdryers, but you should never think you're an expert,
right.
And you should never be satisfied, and listen to everybody, because the most naive suggestions are the best ones, and we always try to approach everything in a naive way.
You're listening to Past Imperfect with Alice Thompson, Rachel Sylvester, and the inventor, James Dyson. We'll be back after this. If you're a student, you can stay up to date on the stories that matter to you by getting a Times Digital subscription for less than 8 pence a day. You'll also get 6 months free access to Perlego's online library of academic resources and tools and access to the extensive Times archive, so you can always be the most informed and well-read person on campus. Subscribe today at thetimes.co.uk/student.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to Past Imperfect with Alice Thompson, Rachel Sylvester, and the inventor, James Dyson. Why did you move into design rather than painting or sculpture? Was there a sense that you wanted to make things that were useful and practical and doing things with your hands? And I wonder whether that's at all to do with losing your father, that you felt there had to be a purpose to your work.
Possibly, might have been underlying that. Now, I went to art school instead of doing voluntary service overseas, because that's what all my friends were doing. But I was really keen on art, and I wanted to go to art school to see if that was what I wanted to do. So I was busy painting life models and doing drawings and things, and the principal invited me into his office. And because if you go to art school, you do a foundation year, and then 3 years of a degree course. So I was in my foundation year. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I think you'd be a good designer. Which was odd, because we didn't do design. We were just doing painting and drawing. And I said, well, what's that? And because, you know, you laugh, you see, but this is... design wasn't on the agenda at all. It wasn't. You couldn't go into any shop and buy a good piece of design. Shops weren't interested in it. Mm. There was a design council in the Haymarket, which had a sort of exhibition space which showcased good design, and they were just starting to get a sort of grip on society. But it was one building in the Haymarket, and even Sunday Times magazine wasn't really showing design, so no newspapers were showing it, and there was none in any shops. So I didn't know what it was. So he explained what it was, and stained glass design, interior design, product design, and it came to furniture design. Well, you know, I was familiar with furniture because I'd sat on chairs and sat at tables and things, so I said, I'd like to do that. And he had had a long association with the Royal College of Art. He'd been there as a student, and he had taught there, and I think he was on the council there. And he knew that they were, just for a year or two, they were doing an experiment, taking in someone from the foundation year who hadn't then done the degree course, And because the Royal College of Art is wholly postgraduate, so you spend 3 years there as a postgraduate student. So I completely skipped the BA course and went straight to doing an MA course. So I managed to get in to the furniture department as a, I mean, I'd spent 4 years there, which I was really thrilled about. It wasn't hardship at all.
Can you remember the first thing you made there?
Yes. I made, we had the most wonderful, there was a proper workshop, and the teacher was the most brilliant cabinet maker, who used to make cabinets for the Queen and Prince Charles and things. And he taught us to do secret lap dovetails. And I don't know if you know what a secret lap dovetail is, but it's a dovetail is hard enough to do.
Yes, I know
but
that.
A secret lap dovetail is a dovetail you can't see, either inside or out, so it's all internal. And we had to make a box of secret lap dovetails. So that was the first thing I made. Oh, not a useful thing at all. But I then went on and made a stool with dovetails that was a magazine rack or a stool, quite big. Made it in ash. Yeah, we called it a bum squeezer because when you sit on it, your buttocks are pushed together.
Have you got it in your house now?
I've got it and I've reproduced it. I've made 6 replicas, which I've given to my children.
Oh, great. And then you did the ball barrow, which you mentioned, sort of wheelbarrow with a ball.
No, I did the sea truck first.
Sea truck.
The landing craft.
But the ball barrow is interesting because that's when you realised you had to be ruthless sometimes in business as well, because I think you didn't patent it and then you effectively got forced out, didn't you? So you realised you had to be quite hard-nosed in business. You couldn't just be a happy-clappy artist.
Yes. I mean, there were 2 problems with that business. One was that I handed over the patent to the company. So I didn't personally own the patent anymore. Mm. And we'd brought in investors, so I only had 30% of the shares. And so they were able to kick me out.
Mm.
I had the idea for the vacuum cleaner, and they poo-pooed it.
And
kicked me out.
So you had the last laugh.
I had the last laugh. It wasn't very nice at the time, but But the real lesson I learned was not to have shareholders and to have control of my own company. So I'm in control of my destiny.
And why did you keep going with 5,127 prototypes of the vacuum cleaner? It is incredible. Did you ever think about giving up? And also, what was it like when you did finally crack it? Was there a eureka moment, or was it a bit of a letdown in the end?
It was a bit of a letdown, to be honest. And it sounds strange, but if you've been pursuing something, trying to solve a problem, when you solve it, you're actually quite exhausted, sort of mentally exhausted. and there's nothing to do anymore. I mean, in my case, there was a lot to do. But if you see what I mean, I'd done that one, and that was no longer an exciting problem to solve. I was on to the next one. And that's true all the time. When you've solved a problem, you're immediately on to the next one, and you've got a better way of doing it. Because while you're doing it, although you've got to finish that one and get that one done and get that one onto the market, you're already on to the next one, and maybe even the next one after that. So the brain is dreaming of the next ones. So that's why you don't break open a bottle of champagne if you've got to afford one, because you know you're worrying about the next one. So it sounds like a horrible life, always to be worried and thinking and trying to solve a problem and moving on. Even when you've done that, you're on to the next one. It's such a fascinating life that you're happy, but you have a crease in your brow all the time. So you could be happy being dissatisfied,
right.
I think is what I'm trying to say.
Mm. What did it feel like having to abandon the Dyson electric car? Because you spent something like 500 million on it, didn't you? Did you regret that at all? Did you think, actually, this is just a learning curve and I'll come back to it?
No, I didn't think of it as a learning curve. It was a waste of money, but it's sort of wrong way to put it. But it was a failure. Painful, very painful failure, and not just financially, but for all the people who worked on it and put their all into it, their creative all into it, and including me. You know, it occupied my life for 5 years, as well as doing other things. So it was just a huge disappointment. Disappointment overshadows everything else. And disappointment also because it was the right thing to be doing. It's just that we could never have made money out of it in the short or medium term. Because it needs explaining, actually, because no one's making money making electric cars. Everybody's losing a fortune making them. And the existing manufacturers do it because across their fleet, they have to have certain emissions of NOx and SOx. And if they have one which has nothing, they can go on making the big gas guzzlers at the other end with impunity. So they, although they don't like losing money on a car, it actually helps them overall. We've got another invention up our sleeves, which is a new technology battery, or we've actually got two technologies which we're putting into production now. And I think that's, because we've got that and we're putting it into production, that's as important, if not more important, than an electric car. Because the Achilles heel of most products, whether it's battery watches or cars or anything, is how long the battery lasts and the danger in the battery. So we've solved that, and we're putting that into production. And I couldn't do both, because putting batteries into production is billions, and so are cars. So as a private company, I couldn't do both. And the government didn't want to help. I went and asked, whereas the Singapore Prime Minister and the Singapore ministers would meet me and help me.
Why are we so short-sighted, do you think, about invention and, you know, innovation in Britain?
We don't like manufacturing.
Is that just snobbery?
Snobbery. Good old-fashioned snobbery. We've never liked it, from Dickens onwards. Dark satanic mills, Blake, you know. 2012 Olympics, those smoking stacks with women, with huge slave women with huge hammers.
Yes, were you upset? Did you feel that
very
you were being
upset.
Personally attacked?
I've never thrown anything at the television, but I nearly threw something at the television. Because the Industrial Revolution created extraordinary wealth and took everybody out of serfdom. It's a wonder. The smoke is not a wonderful thing, but the Industrial Revolution was a wonderful thing.
So we're still Luddites, really, in a way.
We're still Luddites, and we don't like industry. And, you know, when we tried to build a factory here, extend this factory, everybody got up in arms and stopped it. And it was referred to the Secretary of State. And that's what caused me to move, because I needed a factory. What do I do? My sales are doubling every year. What do I do? So we had to go somewhere where they like manufacturing.
Do you think the younger generation is different? Because you prefer to employ young people, don't you, rather than old experts, as you say. Why is that?
Well, because we're trying to do different things and trying to find a new way of doing everything, except perhaps financial accounting. But everything we're trying to do in a new and better way. And it's difficult for people who've learnt the old way and practiced the old way to change to a new way. So I would much rather employ graduates everywhere in the business and find a new way of doing things, and so that they can feel they're pioneering. And I don't have to unteach their old way and teach them a new way.
Is that why you set up the university, so that you could actually do it your way and that you could give people the chance without having to spend a vast amount of money to both work for you and learn at the same time?
Yes, but I have to give Joe Johnson credit, because I went to see Joe Johnson complaining there weren't enough engineers coming out of British universities, which is true. And he said, well, start your own university then. And I didn't think I could do that. And he said, you can't, but you will be able to. So he got his...
This was when he was the minister.
This is when he was the Minister for Higher Education. And he got the bill. The bill went through Parliament, and it was defeated in the Lords, with Chris Patten leading the opposition to defeat it. And then Joe gave me the idea, and then I thought, well, actually, it's a really good idea. I mean, we have a very young corpus here anyway. The average age here is 26, 28, because of my policy of taking in graduates. And we have a very broad spectrum of engineering, going from traditional engineering right through to software, robotics, fluid dynamics, and artificial intelligence, with a broad range of products. One of the most interesting things, I had a lovely email from a graduating engineer 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he said, practicing engineering alongside the world-class scientists and engineers made me really want to learn the academic side. And he said, because of that, I got a first, and I'd never have got a first without having done that. So that was, for me, that was absolute confirmation that what we're doing is the right way of doing things. You know, they're being taught by people who have invented new technology batteries, and some of them are working on the battery project. And I think we've assembled the best robotics software, chemical fluid dynamics engineers that you can get. So they're living and working alongside those people, being inspired by those people. And that must be a wonderful thing. It's hard work. It's a 47-week year. It's not a 22-week academic year. 47-week year. And they are exhausted by the end of it. And we had to give them an extra 2 weeks off because they were so exhausted. But over two-thirds of them got a first. And the rest got two ones.
Mm.
So it's been...
And most of them are staying on to work.
They're all staying on. And
how many people are now applying for it? Because it must be really...
Well, it's really interesting that, because when we started it, I did 1 3-minute slot on the Today programme, Radio 4 Today programme. We got 1,000 applicants, which we were completely astonished by. And these are people who wanted to go to Oxford, Cambridge and Imperial and Russell Group universities. They weren't dropouts. They were very serious people. And we've always had that. We've done no advertising and nobody knows about it. And we've had one or two articles, excellent article in the Times recently with a picture of the students throwing their mortar balls in the air. But apart from that, nobody really knows about it. But news has got around and we get 1,000 applicants. And we don't necessarily take the A-star pupils, although we do look for high academic results. But they spend 2 days here going through lots of tests and, you know, working together, solving problems. Because we don't necessarily want the very, very brainy people who can't apply it. We want a mix of people. And I think we've got that. And the fact that we haven't necessarily chosen the highest academic people, yet more than two-thirds of them have got firsts, was a great tribute to them, how hard they've worked and how involved they've got in everything. And rather interestingly, because we're not a huge university, there's only 150 of them now, 160. But the first cohort, there were only 33 of them. And they bonded as a unit incredibly well and helped each other through difficulties, emotional difficulties and work difficulties.
So you're always trying to shake things up, whether it's a university or commerce, and yearning for change and innovation. Is that why you also back Brexit? And I wonder whether you now feel, looking at how it's working out, whether it's become a rather sort of Little England anti-immigration version of Brexit that isn't that sort of creative, innovative project you wanted.
Well, I would disagree with that, because I don't think that's happened at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to leave largely... I mean, it's called sovereignty, but I call it psychological reasons, that you're much better off if you're on your own and you know you're on your own.
Does that go back to your running?
Well, it goes back to the running, my business and not wanting to be on the stock market and not wanting to be taken over by anybody.
But and are you worried now?
Of course, the best example of that is the vaccine development, where Boris rings up a friend who's a venture capitalist in vaccine and said, get in charge, let's make a vaccine at Oxford. And, you know, we did it. And no one in Europe did it, did they? So it's for those reasons. Mm. And I think when that comes through and we realise we're on our own, we've got to succeed on our own, I think it'll make us stronger and better people.
Do you worry, though, it's about supply chains? I mean, that's the issue, isn't it, that I can see that it makes you much stronger being on your own, but on the other hand, you do need quite a large sort of supply chain throughout Europe and throughout the world to get the products here, as we're seeing at the moment. Is that an issue or not, do you think?
Well, I think it is an issue because Europe's being difficult and making things very difficult at the ports and, of course, in Northern Ireland. So if Europe behaved themselves and were normal and treated us like they do any other country outside the EU, the supply chains would be fine. But we've got to live through this period where they're embittered. But I think when we come out of that, the fact that we will live as neighbours and friends, as we did before we went into Brexit. I mean, so many of us were Francophiles, well, I still am, but before Brexit, before we went into the EU in 1972, I'd just love to go back to that sort of relationship.
And why have you gone into farming in such a big way? Is it very important to you that it stays about food production? Because there's a trend now towards rewilding, bringing back bears and wolves and letting the countryside reclaim the land. What do you feel about that? Or do you think it should stay focused on food production?
Well, I think food production is really important. Being self-sufficient in food is important. And farming well and decently and sustainably is really important. And I certainly don't believe in real wilding. I think it's nonsense. That means you start to import food. And who's going to look after the countryside? Who's going to repair the walls and the fences and the trees and the ditches and the drainage and everything that farmers do as part of being a good farmer? I'm passionate about it, but I wasn't brought up on a farm, but I worked on farms as a schoolboy and as a student in Norfolk. So I think I learned to love farming from that. And I really do enjoy it. And I think in many ways, I mean, this makes it sound nasty, but it's a bit like manufacturing. I mean, if you want to be a manufacturer, then farming is a form of manufacturing.
Mm. So strawberries are like, hairdryers, really. You have Dyson strawberries and
just
Dyson
hairdryers. Just as tasty
hairdryers.
As hairdryers. But, that's... yes, the strawberry thing is interesting because we've got these huge glass houses and we put them next to an anaerobic digester. The anaerobic digester makes electricity from crops or waste crops. And we normally sell the electricity to the grid, but we get very little for it. It's rather like our potatoes and peas and everything else. We give it very little for what we produce. So it's much better to use the heat and the electricity to grow things out of season. So we grow strawberries out of season. The farmers keep calling it in the shoulders of the season, which is a slightly irritating expression, but it means that at either end when you have to fly strawberries in. So from now till Christmas, we'll be growing strawberries, and then we'll be growing strawberries from March through to May. And it's hugely automated. We don't have robots that actually do the picking, but that's the next thing we need.
Right.
We're sponsoring some research at Cambridge on that. We're trying to make farming profitable against the scenario of subsidies being reduced and probably removed completely. Well, they're effectively, for us, they're removed completely because the only monies we get now are for doing planting, for not farming effectively, for having areas of farm where we don't farm. And I'm sure that'll go eventually as well. But I think the country has to think very carefully about farming. It isn't just something you can ignore and let go, because next door to us in Europe, and for that matter in America, Australia, New Zealand, you've got farmers who are heavily subsidised. So if you're growing peas or potatoes, how do you compete against a Dutch farm or a French farm or a Romanian farm that is heavily subsidised? I bought lots of farms, and none of them had a grain store on them. The EU gives capital grants for grain stores. So if you go on a Romanian farm, you'll find wonderful grain stores. Yet none of the farms I bought in England, in Lincolnshire, Oxfordshire or Somerset, had a grain store. So we had to build grain stores.
What did it feel like when you got to 40, which was the age at which your father died? Did you have a sort of gulp moment and think, I've really got to make the most of life now,
well,
even more accelerated?
It's funny you should. Yes, I often think I'm living on borrowed time because both my parents died so young. Now I'm really lucky to have lived so much longer, twice as long as my father. I
mean,
and when I think of the life he had, he was in Burma, India and Burma for 5 years during the war, away from his wife and his young children. And he came back and got cancer almost immediately. I mean, what a rotten life.
Mm. What do you think he'd have been proudest of that you've done? I mean, is there one particular invention that you know would have amused him or entertained him? Or
I think he would have liked a lot of things I've done non-professionally, like sailing and painting and making things, making furniture and so on. I think and some of the play acting I've done. And I think he'd have loved all of that. I've got no idea about... I think he would have loved that I was being creative because he was, I think, desperately wanting to be creative with his life. But I've no idea what he'd think about the whole business side of it.
And looking back to your 9-year-old self sitting in the chapel at his memorial service. What do you wish you'd known then that you know now? Or what advice would you give to your young self?
Not to be worried about not knowing things, about being an expert. That would be really important, because that worried me for a long time. Not to be worried about academic success, but that enthusiasm and curiosity are far greater assets than passing exams, which would give me a bit more confidence, I think, as I started out in life. But I got the brilliant lesson from Jeremy Fry, who is my first employer, first person I worked with. I once suggested that we do some market research for the sea truck landing craft. He said, don't bother with that. It's a great product. Just do it. And that might be a slightly silly outlook, but it's a great outlook, because market research is often bunkum and leads everybody astray. And, you know, you get much more fun out of making a great product, which might not sell very well, than you do doing market research and then the product sells very well. So taking risks and sometimes failing, trying to change things, trying to shake things up, is much more fun than just being successful.
James Dyson, thank you very much for joining us.
You've been listening to Past Imperfect with Alice Thompson, Rachel Sylvester, and the inventor, James Dyson.
This has been a Wireless Studios production for Times Radio, produced by Ben Mitchell.
To make sure you never miss an episode, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts and listen back to our previous guests on the Times Radio app.
We'll be back with another Past Imperfect next week.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode or others in this series, please go to our podcast page or website, where there are links to charities and organisations who are there to help.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavour. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.